B. Collins. Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Tuesday, March 5th, 2019. Your humble host took a ski day yesterday, and I feel invigorated and inspired. And I actually have some good news to open the podcast with today. Too often that's not the case these days in the era of Trump. Is it an oversight, or does Trump hear my plea to restore our Fourth Amendment rights? This broke over the weekend, and Charlie Savage got the story in the New York Times. The advisor on national security matters to the House Minority Leader, a man named Luke Murray, told a group on a video conference over the weekend that the NSA has quietly shut down the system that analyzes logs of Americans' domestic calls and texts, the metadata. Now, this was started by Bush back in 2001. There was no emergency decree that could have been rejected by the Congress. He did it the old-fashioned way. Secret autocracy. He ordered the collection of all our phone records and other surveillance programs. And, yeah, he got the FISA court to approve it. And he briefed, the top eight members of Congress who didn't try to stop it. But this has bothered me for a long time. You may have heard me talk about how I've approached elected officials who have the power and said, give me back my goddamn Fourth Amendment. Now, this may be something that once the news breaks, Trump will say, hey, I like spying. I want to be able to look at the metadata of my political opponents. But for now, it appears that the system has not been used for the last 6 months. Part of that is because of huge blunders where the NSA imported a bunch of phone records from a phone company and they got mixed up with good records and bad records and had to purge it all. Technical irregularities had contaminated their database. And, of course, the agency has declined to comment. But the news that Murray broke is that the system hasn't been used for the last 6 months. And Daniel Schumann, policy director of Demand Progress, a pro-Fourth Amendment group, said, well, since the sky hasn't fallen without the program, and by the way, it has never thwarted a terrorist attack, he said the intelligence community will have to make the case that reviving it is necessary. And as you may know, in 2015, after Snowden, they passed the USA Freedom Act, and all it did was change who was the custodian of the records. Instead of storing them all in NSA servers, the phone companies stored them, the billing records, right? And the NSA could access them with an extra two clicks. Yeah, that was the protection that we were told the USA Freedom Act gave us. But it's expiring at the end of this year. And that requires a review and congressional action to continue it. And get this, as recently as 2016, they collected 151 million phone records in 2017, recent high watermarks. More than half a billion phone records were collected and perhaps analyzed. We don't know. But I hope there is a very strong public debate about renewal of the USA Freedom Act, and I hope that this program is not resumed. Now, they're still watching us. I'm sure you're comforted to know to keep us safe. Last Friday, John Kiriakou published a piece at Consortium News about the Postal Service's mail cover program. It allows postal employees to photograph and send to federal law enforcement organizations the front and back of every piece of mail that they process. And it retains the information digitally, provides it to any government agency that asks for it without a warrant. Now, in 2015, the Postal Inspector General issued a report saying that we need to tighten this up. A mail cover shouldn't be used as a routine tool, and insufficient controls could hinder their ability to conduct effective investigations. Kiriakou says not only were the admonitions ignored, the mail cover program actually expanded after that report's release. And he knows firsthand how it works because while he was in federal prison, as you know, Kiriakou is the only CIA officer who's gone to prison, not because he tortured anybody, because he admitted that other colleagues had done so. So while he was in prison, he had a fellow guy in the joint make a very creative birthday card for his wife's 40th birthday. Part of the tragedy of what Kiriakou has been through is that he and his wife have separated in recent months. Anyway, the birthday card didn't get delivered, and it came back to him 4 months later with two yellow stickers, one with the Elvis song on it, return to sender, address unknown, and the other that was right underneath it said, do not deliver, hold for supervisor, cover program. And so we are still being watched by Big Brother through various means of communication that we use. And, of course, nobody gets anything valuable in the U.S. mail anymore. It's just bills, an occasional check, a lot of junk mail, maybe some packages. But that is the state of surveillance in America today. There's another ugly smear campaign aimed at the Muslim American congresswoman from Minnesota, Ilhan Omar. And it's really ugly. Once again, she has simply been critical of the influence that Israel has on members of the U.S. Congress. And, predictably, Jewish members like Elliot Engel, Nita Lowey, and Jerry Nadler, they characterize what she says as anti-Semitic. And it's really infuriating because there is true anti-Semitism alive on this planet today. In Orange County over the weekend, there were kids painting swastikas. There was the desecration of a Strasbourg Jewish cemetery in recent weeks. That is real anti-Semitism, not someone who criticizes the U.S. for allowing a foreign nation to influence us in a way that is inappropriate. So they're ready to censure her with or without naming her personally. The language reads, accusing Jews of dual loyalty because they support Israel, whether out of a religious connection, a commitment to Jewish self-determination after millennia of persecution, or an appreciation for shared values and interests, suggests that Jews cannot be patriotic Americans and trusted neighbors. She didn't say that or infer it in any way. And frankly, I am not aware, or have not been before this, of this ancient anti-Semitic trope of dual loyalty. And the sensitivities of these people who have so much power and whose power is buttressed by the collaboration of people who get campaign contributions from those affiliated with the Israel lobby in this country is very clear for all to see. And I give a lot of credit to Congresswoman Omar. So first, Nita Lowey tweeted, I'm saddened that Omar continues to mischaracterize support for Israel. And Omar responded, I should not be expected to have allegiance/pledge support to a foreign country in order to serve my country in Congress or serve on a committee. And AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, has come to her defense, suggesting that comments expressing racism or bigotry toward Latinos have never sparked such a furious backlash or any kind of a censure request from members of Congress. And over the weekend, I did something I rarely do, and I counsel Ms. Omar to resist going on Twitter. But I saw this exchange between her and Brett Stevens, the New York Times op-ed columnist who used to be the editor of the Jerusalem Post. And Stevens had tweeted that Omar and others would benefit from a book called Anti-Semitism for Dummies. And as a dummy myself, I couldn't resist, so I tweeted back at him, well, look, if I were to say that Senator Chuck Schumer and Senator Bob Menendez show allegiance to AIPAC, is that only 50% anti-Semitic because Menendez isn't Jewish? The trigger point for anti-Semitism has been set so low, particularly for a woman who wears a headscarf. And Phyllis Bennis, at the Institute for Policy Studies, a woman I deeply respect, She published a piece. I've linked to it in the show file for this podcast. She reviews real anti-Semitism, how in the United States it's often linked to white supremacy. She talks about false accusations of anti-Semitism. And then she offers this. If Omar had written a formal statement instead of a tweet, if she had issued a serious analysis of how every lobby, including the pro-Israel lobby led by AIPAC, directs funds to ensure support from members of Congress, rather than casually quoting Puff Daddy that it's all about the Benjamins, the response would have been the same, because it's far more about who she is than what she said. And what she actually said, here's the full quote. I want to talk about the political influence in this country that says it's okay for people to push for allegiance to a foreign country. And I want to ask, why is it okay for me to talk about the influence of the NRA, of fossil fuel industries, or Big Pharma, and not talk about a powerful lobby that is influencing policy? She continued, I am told every day that I am anti-American if I'm not pro-Israel. I find that to be problematic, and I'm not alone. I just happen to be willing to speak up on it and open myself to attacks. I should not be expected to have allegiance / pledge support to a foreign country in order to serve my country in Congress or serve on committee. The people of my 5th district elected me to serve their interest. And here's a new low. Juan Vargas, a Democrat from California in the House, he rejected her comment as anti-Semitic, even though that is really not in evidence. And then he said, questioning support for the U.S.-Israel relationship is unacceptable. Well, Juan Vargas, you're full of shit. And I hope somebody else will explain that to you in frank language like that. But our friend Phyllis Bennis closes by offering a somewhat optimistic note. She said, criticizing Israel is no longer political suicide, even those if those inside the D.C. bubble haven't realized it yet. But she said, young people are changing the tone. The BDS movement is having an impact. And the attacks are escalating precisely because the movement for Palestinian rights is winning the fight for public opinion. Well, Phyllis, I hope you're right about that. I certainly do. And over at The Intercept, Mehdi Hassan has a good piece recapping the president's cringeworthy comments about Israel. Some of his tweets that are, I think, arguably anti-Semitic. And Mehdi Hassan also quotes Republican members of the House who refer to themselves as David Duke without the baggage. Over the weekend, Jim Jordan, the guy who was so tough on Michael Cohen at the hearing last week, the former wrestling coach from Ohio State, he tweeted that Tom Steyer, the guy who's been spending $50 million promoting impeachment in TV ads, well, he tweeted a criticism of Steyer, who is Jewish, or at least of Jewish parents, and he spelled the name Steyer with a dollar sign. Now, I don't hear anybody ready to censure Jim Jordan for that. And, of course, we know the true anti-Semitism that's been expressed in the brutal mass murder at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh. And so to see true anti-Semitism conflated with these opportunistic uses of smears based on anti-Semitism is really troubling. It certainly is. Every day I pause for a moment to thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. People like Bill Janetta, Ted Kelly, Brian Massey, Terry Paris. They all kick in $5 or $10 a month. And if you're saying, I could do that, well, let's do it. Come on over to peterbcollins.com, click on the menu tab, pull down Become a Subscriber. You land on the sign-up page, $5, $10, $20 a month. You get a bonus book with a $50 annual subscription and your mailing address in the continental U.S. I have a few more copies of Dr. Justin Frank's Trump on the Couch. I'd like to send one to you, so take out an annual subscription today, and we'll take care of that. Today I'm releasing to my subscribers an in-depth interview that has not yet been broadcast. It was recorded for local television here in Marin County, California. And we take up the issue of California's rogue utility, as I call it, Pacific Gas and Electric. They're in bankruptcy. Huge liabilities facing them for causing wildfires in 2017 and 2018. And so I talked with Tim Redmond. He's the former managing editor of the San Francisco Bay Guardian. He now publishes at a local news site called 48hills.org in San Francisco, a longtime critic of PG&E, and he knows the history. He joined me along with activist Eric Thrasher, who has set up a petition drive urging our elected officials to take PG&E and make it a publicly owned utility. And in this excerpt, Tim Redmond sums up the benefits if we take that step.
When I hear people say, oh, well, the state shouldn't take over PG&E, we'd have to take all of its liabilities too. We're going to have to do that anyway. Either the ratepayers or the taxpayers, and that's, by the way, Peter, that's you and me both. Right?
Yeah.
We're both ratepayers and taxpayers. We're going to have to shoulder the cost of this one way or another. So why not, as you say, cut out the middleman? For a couple of $1 billion, we could have bought controlling interest, and then we could have had people manage it, or we could have done what a lot of people are suggesting, which is break it up. It's too big anyway. Mm-hmm. And parcel it out to, for example, I think Marin Clean Energy would be in a perfect position to provide public power to Marin and Sonoma counties. We already have a public power. We have East Bay MUD. We already have a municipal utility district in the East Bay that could take over the East Bay. I am sure that Sacramento Municipal Utility District would love to run down to Vacaville. And San Francisco can take over the part for San Francisco and the peninsula. We could have public power all over Northern California. The way, by the way, Congress originally intended with the Raker Act. Mm-hmm. And guess what? Our rates are going to go down. Safety record is going to go way, way up, because we're not going to have that incentive to take money away from public safety to pay a multi-million dollar salaries to top executives. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, every public power agency in Northern California finishes the year with a surplus, with extra money that you can use to either lower rates even more, to underground wires where they're above ground and dangerous,
yeah,
to provide additional funding for renewable energy, for small-scale solar, for loans for small-scale solar, for renewables. PG&E makes a very large profit, the billions of dollars every year. Why can't, if we're going to pay the costs anyway, what we have essentially done with PG&E is we have socialized the costs and problems and privatized the revenue.
Indeed.
That's journalist Tim Redmond talking about Pacific Gas and Electric. And the package is available for you today at peterbcollins.com. Subscribers can access the audio portion as a podcast, and everybody can click on the link to the video, which is available for delivery to any of your devices. So Juan Guaido, who was kind of on the lam, unsure if the Maduro government would allow him to re-enter Venezuela after he left to help stage the phony humanitarian aid drive coming in from the border with Colombia. Well, he arrived back in Caracas yesterday. They had a safety crew for him, diplomats from the U.S., Germany, and Spain, but they didn't try to detain him, and Guaido left with his passport and went immediately to a rally where he once again urged people to overthrow the elected leader, Nicolas Maduro. And last night I watched on PBS a deeply biased segment about Venezuela. And the PBS NewsHour seems to see its function as that of a state media organ these days. There was no hint of criticism that the action by the United States to recognize Guaido is not legitimate. Nope, they don't touch that. They put air quotes around him being recognized, but that's it. And so they trotted out the ambassador, who has no credentials, but has been recognized by the bloody crew of Bolton, Abrams, and Pompeo. His name is Vecchio, and he was allowed to spew all kinds of falsehoods and claims, and the PBS anchor really didn't do anything to force him to prove things or to contradict him. And so I put up a link to the clip on Facebook, and I said, PBS plays the role of state media in this biased report on Venezuela. It is spun totally in support of the Trump-Bolton-Abrams regime change, dressed up as humanitarian intervention. The would-be ambassador Vecchio has no credentials, but since he is recognized by Trumpco with the approval or silence of just about all Democrats, he is allowed to spew unchallenged. So we have to keep an eye on the media. And Paul Elsesser, a longtime supporter of this podcast, shared a link to the latest critique of media coverage here in the United States of the Venezuela story, published by Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. And Paul also suggests that when I refer to the corporate media, that I should call it the corporate propaganda ministry. That would be more accurate, Paul. Thank you. He also quotes General Smedley Butler, who worked in he was in the Marine Corps, and he was deployed in Mexico, Haiti, Cuba, Nicaragua, Dominican Republic, and China way back when. A speech that he gave in 1933 ended this way. I served in all commission ranks from second lieutenant to major general. During that period, I spent most of my time being a high-class muscle man for big business, for Wall Street, and for the bankers. In short, I was a racketeer, a gangster for capitalism. Now, that is an accurate description of John Perkins, who wrote a book about being an economic hitman. His visits to this podcast have been the most downloaded episodes over the almost 10 years that I've been podcasting. And in a dispatch that I got by email today from John Perkins, he sets a scene at a bar in Mexico City where he is joined by a friend named Juan. And John and Juan go back and forth. Juan says, you know, if it weren't for the idiotic countries, life would be great. And John says, which countries? And Juan says, well, right now, Venezuela and the one imitating it. You think the U.S. is imitating Venezuela, says John. Juan says, you know, Venezuela was one of the most wealthy countries on the planet. Back in the 1950s, it ranked in the top five per capita. Under the dictatorship of Perez Jimenez from 1952 to 1958, the economy soared. But things took a dark turn, and the gap between the rich and poor expanded dramatically. And that's the comparison he makes with the U.S. imitating Venezuela. There's more to it. And if you follow the link in the show file, you can read it at peterbcollins.com. Another important note, a group of election observers who were there in Venezuela in May of last year have challenged the characterization by the European Union that election had irregularities. And in an open letter, they say, look, we were there, we examined the electoral system. It's sophisticated. It is fraud-proof. And everything is monitored by members of all parties. We would be interested to hear of examples of the reporting irregularities that you cited. We doubt you have any evidence to back up your claim of numerous reporting irregularities. We were unanimous, including the elections were conducted fairly. They were not biased. That genuine irregularities were exceptionally few and minor in nature. The claims in your press release are fabrications of the most disgraceful kind, based on hearsay and not on evidence, and unworthy of the European Union. And get this, we see these bloodthirsty guys like Bolton and Pompeo and Abrams showing their soft side, the humanitarian concerns they have for the poor and the unaddressed health issues of children in Venezuela. But it's been reported over the weekend that a dual American-Saudi citizen has been locked up at that Ritz-Carlton jail since November of 2017, and he's been tortured. He was slapped, blindfolded, stripped to his underwear, bound to a chair, shocked with electricity. And his name is Walid Fitahihi, a Harvard-trained physician. And they don't even go through the motions like they did for Khashoggi. This is very stunning, all right? We don't even have a hint of criticism for the torture of an American in Saudi Arabia. But oh, are we concerned? So concerned about Venezuela that we've got to impose regime change. And how so many people can't see through this is bizarre to me. There are only a handful of Americans who have accepted themselves. Bernie Sanders has clearly said he opposes military intervention, but his criticism of the election and of the Maduro government, I think, is designed to insulate him from being called a Venezuelan socialist Democrat. And this will continue. Well, Trump is going to lose the first round on congressional approval of his emergency decree, where he believes he can grab money authorized for other purposes to fund the construction of a wall on our southern border. Senator Rand Paul has done us a big favor. He joined three other Republicans over the weekend. Those other three are Collins of Maine, Murkowski of Alaska, Tillis of North Carolina. This means Democrats have a total of 51 votes to block approval of Trump's emergency decree. Now, it's not veto-proof, and it's likely that Trump will prevail in the end, and then it goes to the courts. But the most remarkable thing that Rand Paul said about this is that he thinks that the guys who Trump has packed the court with, Kavanaugh and Gorsuch, would join the majority in ruling against the administration and the National Emergency Declaration. Quoting Rand Paul, "Without question, the president's order for more wall money contradicts the will of Congress and will in all likelihood be struck down by the Supreme Court. In fact, I think the president's own picks to the court may rebuke him on this." Now, Jerry Nadler, the now muscular chair of the House Judiciary Committee, has followed up on the Cohen testimony by demanding documents from more than 60 people, cronies or family members of Trump. Now, I fully support this. I think all of this should be investigated. But Nadler is maddening because he says his goal is to present the case to the American people about obstruction of justice, corruption, and abuse of power. He told ABC that it's very clear to him that the president has obstructed justice, that Cohen directly implicated the president in various crimes that would be an impeachable offense. But impeachment is a long way down the road. Now, we're already gearing up for the 2020 elections. And any further delay of impeachment means that it can't happen until Trump is elected to a second term. This is disingenuous and it's irrational. It's incoherent. If he is obviously guilty of obstruction of justice, impeach the bastard. Don't play games with us. Oh, yeah, they're going to investigate Jared's security clearance and the way Trump did that. But these are parking tickets, and Trump will ignore them with impunity. The only way to get his attention and to force him to change his behavior is to impeach him. And Democrats, for whatever strategic or poll-based reasons, are just too timid to take the move that the Constitution demands and start the impeachment process. Trump does appear ready to declare victory and walk away from the trade war with China. China's been feverishly writing up documents that suggest that they'll change their policies. But they're not really binding. They don't have the force of law. They don't have much detail. And Trump wants to, he desperately needs a win. And so we are being told that sources inside the White House say that he is going to agree to lift the sanctions on China. They will lift sanctions on the United States. Tariffs, I should say, not sanctions. And even over at the American Enterprise Institute, where corporate pigs go to the trough, a resident scholar, Derek Scissors, says, "Can we go back to the pre-tariff days? Yes, we can. Have we moved the bar since the beginning of the Trump administration? The answer is no." And economists at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York estimate that this has reduced incomes in the United States by $7 billion, and it's been costing consumers and importers a total of $4.5 billion a month. Now, the Chinese economy has been forced into recession. That hurts American companies, too. And as you know, I am not opposed to tariffs. But this irrational way that Trump has operated, picking fights with Canada over dairy imports and calling it a national security issue, it's led to confusion, uncertainty in the markets. And nothing good has come of it. Just ask the soybean farmers in Iowa. Here in California, it's not a surprise, but another disappointment. As Stephon Clark, the 22-year-old man who was shot and killed by police in Sacramento last summer because he was armed only with a cell phone. Now, I understand it was a difficult situation for the cops. Stephon Clark was acting erratically. He was on drugs. He was despondent, threatening to kill himself. But none of that really matters. The cops came on a scene with this man who jumped over a fence into his own grandmother's backyard. And they didn't try to de-escalate the situation in any way. They fired at him. They fired 20 bullets at Stephon Clark. You might be able to rationalize or justify one. But when you shoot somebody and they don't shoot back or make any effort to threaten you, you don't just keep pulling the trigger. That has got to change. Up north in Canada, Justin Trudeau's got another problem. A second cabinet minister has announced her resignation because of pressure on the justice minister to back away from a criminal case against a construction company that was alleged to have paid bribes in Libya. And it is Justin, not Pierre Trudeau, as I misstated on Friday. And finally today, we started with some good news. We're going to end with some good news here in the podcast. For only the second time since the global epidemic of AIDS began in the 1980s, a patient appears to have been cured of the infection HIV. This is something we never thought possible. In the dark days of the 1980s, I saw coworkers and friends get sick and die. And it appeared hopeless. As if much of the gay population in the United States might be wiped out. And despite the fact that the pharmaceutical industry found it unprofitable to develop drugs to address HIV, they have. And in this case, it was a bone marrow transplant that ended the presence of the virus in a human who is being referred to only as the London patient. Almost 10 years ago, the first person described as cured, known as the Berlin patient, was later identified as Timothy Brown, age 52, who is still alive, still HIV-free, and lives in Palm Springs, California. Thanks for listening to my daily news and comment podcast. You're free to share it all over the place. You'll find it on YouTube, and I remain Peter B.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.